Welcome to the Dignity and Respect in Action podcast. This series is brought to you by the UMass Office of Equity and Inclusion and features members of the university community and other experts in the field of diversity, equity, and inclusion. In these episodes, we'll learn about the work and experiences of our guests and gain insight from their expertise. Your host for this podcast is Dr. Nefertiti Walker, Interim Vice Chancellor of Equity and Inclusion and Professor of Sport Management in the Eisenberg School of Management. And now, here's Nef.
Hello, and welcome back to the Dignity and Respect in Action podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Nef Walker. In our last episode, we spoke with Dr. Ray Walker from the College of Nursing about their unexpected path to working at UMass, as well as innovation and bias in health technology. Today, we're continuing our month-long series on women and gender diversity at UMass, and I'm very happy to welcome the Associate Dean of Student Recruitment, Inclusion, and Success at the Commonwealth Honors College, Dr. Anne-Marie Russell, to the show. Anne-Marie, it's so great to have you here with us today. I'm particularly excited because I feel like we've developed a work-friend relationship, so it's nice to have you here.
Yeah. Thank you, Nef. I'm actually a huge fan of this podcast, so it's really a thrill and an honor for me to be here talking with you as well.
Oh, that's good. I'm glad to hear that you're listening. It still surprises me when people say that they listen to the podcast. I'm like, oh, you do?
It's really, really well done. It's good. My husband and I listen to it together.
Good. That's exciting. Yeah. We appreciate that. We appreciate everyone that listens because we're trying to tell intimate, authentic stories about the folks in our community. So we appreciate that. Great. So I like to start off by asking, our guests to tell us a little bit about yourself and the path that has led you to be part of the UMass community. And I know your story goes deeper than your work life here. So I'm excited to hear that. And can you tell us how you came to UMass and to your current role as Associate Dean as well?
Sure. So thank you for that question. So the first thing to know about me is what you alluded to, which is that my roots at UMass go deep. They go really far back because UMass is a place where I came of age as an undergraduate. And it's a place where I kind of came into my own as a young adult. And it's actually the place that kind of shaped and fostered my current value system, at least when it comes to social justice issues. So it's very much intertwined. UMass Amherst is very much intertwined into my identity. In terms of how I got here, so my introduction to UMass happened a few decades ago now, when I was 17 years old. And I was living in inner city Boston. I grew up in a Jamaican immigrant household where no one else had gone to college. And I was a high school kid and I didn't have very much guidance as to what to do, like how to make decisions about my next step. And so I think I did what a lot of other kids do at that age or students do at that age, which is I look to media influences. And in my case, the influence that I listened to is a little embarrassing, but I was actually a big fan of the show Beverly Hills 90210. And my favorite characters in that show had moved on to college. And it was actually my first time seeing what a college campus looked like. I'd never seen like a big grassy scenic campus where people are sitting outside and it's sunny. Like that was, I didn't have that concept of college before. And so once I saw that, I was like, I think I want that. And so I went to my after school job and I said, do you know of any colleges that have nice campuses? And they said, Amherst. And that is literally the beginning and end of how I ended up at UMass Amherst. I heard it was a nice campus. I knew that it was close enough to home, but also far enough away from home. And so I applied, I got in sight unseen, and I went here and had the best 4 years of my life.
That's amazing. All of that's amazing, but I love that it starts with 90210.
I know, I'm embarrassed by that, but it's the truth.
No, you shouldn't be. I love that part of that story because I feel like so many of us, you know, when we're younger, when we're in our early or late teens, we're trying to craft the story of our life and who we want to be through what we're consuming, right? Whether it's the books we're reading, the TV shows we're watching. So I love the story of how that sort of got you here to UMass.
Right.
So take us beyond that point, right? So you're here at UMass. What are some of the things that you did for those 4 years as a student here that shaped who you are?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I had such a great experience here. Initially, so as a first gen student, I had no idea what I was doing. I was completely clueless. So I had been given advice by somebody who had kind of dipped their toe in college, but didn't necessarily succeed. But this was somebody who lived in my neighborhood in Boston. And they said, you know, college is a place where you don't really have to go to class because the professor doesn't check whether or not you're attending. And so I said, oh, if I don't have to go to class, I'll just schedule my work times like during some of my classes, which is what I did my first semester. And that was not a winning strategy. Okay. Like what I would do is I would read the chapters and just turn up on exam days. And that's not sufficient. You have to actually get the instruction and the engagement. Yeah. So I actually fell flat on my face my first semester here and thought about dropping out. But my mother, because we had already paid for the year, convinced me to stick it out. And so I ended up sort of writing a manifesto for what I wanted the rest of my life to look like and for the success I wanted to try to achieve at UMass. And that ended up really shifting my mindset. I just came in determined to figure this out and to prove myself. And despite the fact that I didn't know what I was doing, I was going to figure it out. And so my sophomore year, I actually started making 4.0s. It actually ended up working out. I met really great mentors and I started doing really well. I started excelling academically. I fell in love with psychology and social psychology in particular. I love the research. I love research as a tool and I love data. And so I found my academic passions here. At the same time, I was developing my social identities here as well. And so coming from a Jamaican immigrant family, my particular family did not reflect very much on race. And so I grew up in mostly Black neighborhoods. So it wasn't necessary for me to identify so much with my Blackness as my Jamaican-ness, my Caribbean immigrant heritage. So when I got to UMass is when I actually kind of found out that I was Black. Like when people looked at me, they saw a Black person.
Yeah.
And the first time I realized that was when my roommate told me that her family didn't actually want her to live with me because I was Black. Wow. That shocked me into racial consciousness, that this is the one thing that people see and respond to, despite the kind of human being that I am. And So I ended up going through like all of these racial identity stages that Bill Cross talks about, where because of the shock of racism, and I also lived on an all white floor, it was the nursing tap floor, I came in as a nursing major. I was just very aware of my Blackness and how people received me because of it. And so I ended up taking social justice courses through the Department of Education here. And that was what shaped my worldview and helped me to understand what I was experiencing, that it wasn't just individual aggression, that it was part of a larger system of oppression and, you know, intentional, you know, institutionalized racism, but also intentional. So that like opened up a whole new world for me, realizing that there were all these complexities, that there were these structures of oppression, and of course lit a fire in me, like it does for I think a lot of students. And so I've identified with being a social justice activist ever since then. So that's what UMass sparked in me. It was my academic passions as well as my personal, social, my cultural, my societal commitments. So I worked in community service learning. I started an organization here called the Multicultural Association of Psychology Students. I was a tour guide. I was a peer advisor for the Honors College. I was a peer advisor for what was pre-major advisor. I was a very active student and I just totally loved and absorbed all of my UMass experience.
Yeah, thank you for that story. One, sort of, I think it's important for listeners, faculty, staff, students, alums, community members to hear the experiences of Black folks, you know, coming to terms with Blackness. And I think so often people assume, well, you know, you've been Black your whole life. You know what it means to deal with racism. You're fine. You're good. And I think so many of our students come in and rightfully so, they're nurtured, right? They're nurtured in their homes. They're nurtured in their communities to be whole people. And they're not having to consider their Blackness every single day. And I think when you are, you know, a Black person or a Black student or anyone coming from an underrepresented group and coming on our campus, predominantly white institution, you have to reckon with that. Exactly. So I love that you shared that story because it allows us to understand what that reckoning might look like and feel like. And I think, you know, it allows listeners the opportunity to be empathetic to it. So thank you for sharing that.
Well, I think it's also, you're welcome, important to know that that's a pretty almost universal experience. Not mm-hmm. that everyone has a roommate that doesn't want to live with them. And it wasn't my roommate's fault, it was her family. But that you go to college and you experience not being accepted or experience being racialized in a particular way. Uh-huh. And you have to figure out how you're going to get through that, how you're going to negotiate that. The fact that you realize for the first time, wow, I'm surrounded by racism, right? Yeah. I am a minority. I am a token in this classroom. A lot of people have to navigate those challenges. And what was helpful for me about UMass and what I appreciate about UMass, having worked at lots of other institutions since then, is that I felt like they had the tools to help me navigate that. Between the Social Justice Education Program and the Office of Community Service Learning, there are people who are deeply thoughtful about issues and matters of social justice who are prepared to support you through that. And there are also like student, you know, the Black Student Union, you know, groups that I could lean on to help me understand myself racially and then understand who I wanted to be. Beyond, you know, that racial immersion period.
Yeah, no, that's helpful. Tell us a little bit more about your current position as Associate Dean.
Sure. So in keeping with my theme that I love UMass, one of the things that I had planned to do since I was here as an undergrad, my big dream was actually to always come back here and kind of pay it forward. I wanted to give other people the kind of opportunities that I had and the kind of support that I got. So I stayed in higher ed after UMass. I worked at a bunch of private elite institutions and at some point signaled to UMass that I was interested in coming back. And I was very fortunate that the office of the provost was receptive. And so Kathy Newman, the provost then, was the first person who kind of started the recruitment process. And then Provost John McCarthy saw the rest of that process through. And so I worked for UMass for 2 years as an associate provost for data and analytics. It was a wonderful job. I loved it. But then this opportunity came up and I was very drawn to it. So I am currently an associate dean at the Commonwealth Honors College, and the areas that I oversee are recruitment and outreach, and that includes overseeing internal admissions, on-campus admissions, and also outreach to prospective high school students and transfer students. I am responsible for co-curricular and extracurricular student programming. And all the major events that the Commonwealth Honors College puts on, like Black History Month, and the Mass Undergraduate Research Conference. And then I'm also responsible for overseeing the Emerging Scholars Program, which is this wonderful, incredible program for highly talented students from underrepresented backgrounds. And it immerses them in a living and learning experience. It's a residential academic program that takes place in Melville. And so I oversee that program, I oversee those students, and I also teach a course and take them on a study abroad trip. So it's sort of a broad portfolio, but those are my main areas of oversight.
Thank you. And are there any projects? I mean, the Emerging Scholars initiative sounds amazing, and I've been familiar with that one over the course of my years here. Mm-hmm. And the amazing work that the students do and the projects that they come back and present to folks is just a really, yes, really cool program. Are there any projects that you're working on right now that you're particularly excited about?
Yeah, so there are a few that I'd like to quickly promote here. So one of them is Pizza and Prof, which is this opportunity that we create for students to get to know professors in a sort of informal and intimate setting. And professors present a little bit on their work and then students engage in Q&A with them. And we had one in February with Paul Musgrave. It was amazing. And we have another one coming up on March 25th, this Thursday, and that will be hosted by Lisa Troy. I'm not sure if this will air before Thursday, but if it does, then I want your listeners to know about that. Another event that I'm really excited about is a panel that's still in the works that's called Taking Flight. And that is a panel of alumni, particularly those who graduated last year in the pandemic, who are talking to graduating seniors about what it's like to step in, out of UMass and into the real world. And in particular, during a time of crisis, economic crisis and all kinds of other crises. So that's something that we're putting together for April. And then finally, we're hosting the Mass Undergraduate Research Conference, which is a conference, it's statewide, that showcases undergraduate research. And I'm really excited about our keynote speaker. Her name is Zara Caldwell. She's a very dynamic speaker from Westfield State University. And then we also have a leadership panel where our own Swami, Chancellor Swami, as well as two other college presidents, Javier Ceballos from Framingham State and Laura Douglas from Bristol Community College, they're gonna have a panel with each other, a discussion with each other about their own undergraduate research and how it impacted their own professional journeys. And our undergraduate student researchers will also be engaging with them. And this is something that they wanted to do, was to directly engage with the students rather than doing something that was recorded.
Yeah.
So I'm really excited about that panel and I hope people get a chance to check it out. And that's on April 23rd.
Thank you. No, you all have a lot going on. You have a really big job.
I do.
You have a really big job. And I certainly you're the best person for that job. Still it's a really big job and a really important job. I'm excited for all the cool things that you're going to do as Associate Dean in the Honors College. I'm also sad to have you leave because I did work with you a bit in your previous role in data analytics in the provost office. But it's nice to still have you on campus doing things that I feel like are definitely aligned with your passions and your previous experiences.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And I was able to carry through my passions for social justice and DEI work through data and analytics.
Like absolutely.
I was able to use data to support that work, but I also wanted to be more student facing, and mm-hmm. I just love the expansiveness of this particular role. So I was just drawn to it.
Definitely. So I want to talk a little bit about your transition from being in grad school, right? And I've looked up some articles that we have written on you as a campus, mm-hmm. as well as other articles that have been written about you and your experiences. And I want to talk about the change that you made from being in grad school and having this academic research trajectory to focusing on institutional research and that career path. Like how did that happen? How did that change or that shift in your focus happen? But also, a change like that takes a lot of courage, right? You jump into a PhD program and it's like, okay, this is what I'm going to do. I'm going to be a faculty mm-hmm. member. I'm going to do academic research. And then you shift to say, no, I'm going to do what I consider is service, right? Service to the public good, service to your individual institution, service to students, service to faculty and staff. How did you have the courage to make that shift? And what moved you to make that shift?
Well, thank you for that question. And thank you for putting it that way. I had not thought of it that way in terms of courage. So I definitely went into Princeton believing that I was going to become an academic. Like you said, you tapped everything about my narrative perfectly. And I've never not finished anything that I've started. So it was really hard. It took me 2 or 3 years to come to terms with the fact that I was not enjoying what I was doing. I got into the field of social psychology and social policy because I wanted to make a direct impact on issues that I was passionate about, issues of diversity, equity, and inclusion. And I felt like the work that I was doing in research was not direct and would not really have a big impact. And even if it did, it would be about I respect scholarship, I respect academics, but I felt like in the environment that I was in, there was more focus on developing your personal career, and I had more of a focus on affecting these issues that I cared about. And so I just started to realize that this path wasn't fitting for me. And so it took me a couple of years to understand that it wasn't just nerves, it wasn't a matter of confidence. I wasn't having a bad day, And so I eventually came to terms with that. And then I just had to figure out how to tell my advisor.
Yeah.
And then talk her out of thinking that I was having a bad day. And eventually she accepted it, because I realized when I was getting prepped for the job market, I wanted no part of it. Like, there was no part of it that was appealing to me. And again, yeah, like, I completely respect my academic peers. But that path is not for everybody. And for the people who it's for, you have to 100% want it.
Yeah.
It's a lot of work. You have to be fully and wholly committed to it. And that just wasn't where I was. So I pivoted. I stopped where I was. And once I did that, once I had that clarity that this wasn't what I wanted and what I wanted to make an impact, opportunities actually started coming to me. And so while I was at Princeton, the Office of the Dean of Students asked me to take on a research project where I would examine the outcomes of lower income students who were matriculating at Princeton over the prior 10 years, because Princeton has a very generous scholarship program and had been bringing in students for free, basically, and wanted to know, okay, now that we've done this, how are they faring? And so that was a topic that was close to my heart. That was a topic that the institutional leadership asked me to look into, which meant that it was something that was going to be listened to.
Yeah.
And it was a place where I felt like, okay, I can make a direct impact. I can do all the fun data stuff, like all the analysis, and I can see tangible results coming from the work that I do. I'm creating new knowledge that can be immediately acted upon. And that's exactly what happened. And that's how I fell in love with the field of institutional research. Was because of that program. And then after that, I got offered a position at Bates College to be the director of institutional research there. And from there, I was recruited to UMass, and the rest is history.
Yeah, no, And again, I do think it's absolutely courageous. There are so many people who go through, they start PhD programs or they start, you know, graduate programs, and they very quickly realize that this isn't what I thought it would be. I'm not going to be able to do the things that I want to do. And they just push forward and they jump into that career and they're not as happy as they could be. They're not as productive as they could be because they're not really doing what they want. So I think, you know, to be able to acknowledge that and call it out at that point in your, you know, very young career is courageous, right?
Thank you.
And I think it's important for people to hear that story, to know it's okay to shift gears, to pivot.
It was the best decision I ever made. I am happy. Yeah. I'm so happy in my career. I really am.
Yeah, no, that's great. So I think that's important. That's an important story to tell. And I'm sure, you know, if we had time to dig deeper, there would be so much nuance into how you came to that decision and what parts of the academic life were things that you wanted no part of, right? I remember you saying that.
Yeah.
And I feel a big part of whatever makes you feel welcomed or like you belong in a particular industry has to do with your personal identities, right? And there's lots of research that supports how difficult it can be to be a Black woman in the academy, but also to be a Black woman in higher ed in general, right?
Yes.
To be a Black woman in executive type positions like an associate dean.
Right.
So I want to talk a little bit about being a woman plus being Black, African-American, person of color, as well as being of, you know, Jamaican immigrants and all of that wrapped into being in a leadership position. On a predominantly white, on a predominantly white institution type campus. Tell us, you know, some of your frustrations with having to navigate those identities in this space. As much as, you know, I say we as in the Office of Equity and Inclusion, but also I think just, you know, our UMass community, as much as we try to create these spaces that are inclusive and equitable and welcome diversity, we also acknowledge the fact that we're fighting against, you know, centuries of racism and sexism and all of that being institutionalized. So, share with us just some of your frustrations and also some of the rewards of navigating those identities on our campus and your role as a leader.
So the majority of my experience here has been through my work in the provost office. And I have to say that there I was pretty behind the scenes, and my affiliation with the provost was very helpful. I think that that almost helped overcome some of the discrimination I might have experienced otherwise. So in my previous position, when I worked in analytics in my previous position, I was the petite Black woman in the office, and there was a tall white man in the office. And guess who they thought was the leader when people would walk in? You know, it was never their eye, people's eyes when they first walked into our institutional research office would go toward him. But I was the leader of the office. And so I definitely knew that being Black and female fed into my default credibility. You know, it fed into people's presumptions of what I was capable of. And I was always a surprise. You know, people weren't expecting me to walk in the room when they heard of the director of institutional research and analytics at Bates College. So so I have experienced it in my life, but not in the provost office. Provost office was a very good experience. And I had a great friend there, Farshid Hajir, who used to check in with me all the time about that specific issue. And I would say, I'm actually okay when it comes to that. As an associate dean, though, I've only been in the position for about 3 months, and I'm actually still in the honeymoon period, so I'm still very, very happy about everything. But I have started to encounter issues where there's a tension that I'm trying to negotiate between the kind of leader that I want to be, right, the kind of leader that aligns with my value system, and the kind of leader that I have to be because of my positionality. So for example, I, a long time ago, and actually this was the influence of Dan Clausen, who was a sociology professor here, I stopped buying into systems of hierarchy. And I also stopped buying into markers of hierarchy and power differentials, which for me means I prefer not to be addressed by my title or even by my degree. I prefer to be addressed by my first name. That's just my preference. And I respect everyone else's preference. And I grew up in a hierarchical culture, so I can still show respect to hierarchy, but it's just not something that I buy into. And so I've wanted to, you know, I was asked what I want to be called, and I said, I want to be called Anne Marie. Well, people who have walked my path before, you know, mentors who are women of color, both older than me and my contemporaries said, as a woman of color, just know that you are not going to be accorded the same respect if you don't have these credentials by your name. So if you don't introduce yourself and almost prove your worthiness of standing in that room to a certain degree, then by default, people are going to assume that you, they're not going to presume your competence. They're not going to presume that you belong there. And so in order to overcome that, in order to negate that, to neutralize that, I need to ask to be addressed as Associate Dean Russell or Dr. Russell. And so those are some thoughts that I'm sitting with right now, because it's not who I am, but people are saying it's who I have to be. And these are very wise people. So I'm still working through that.
So that resonates with me. Because I've had similar conversations with people who are adamant about calling me Dr. Walker, or, you know, now Vice Chancellor Walker. And I tell my students, call me what you would like. You can call me Neff, you can call me Dr. Walker, you can call me Professor Walker, you can call me Dr. Neff, which a lot of students now call me. But I agree. And I absolutely respect your perspective, right? If the only way that you can get respect and the only way that you can command the attention of a room is by throwing a doctor or professor or associate dean in front of your name, what does that mean for the people in that room or space that can't do that? Are they less worthy of respect? What are we signaling when we only demand respect by titles and we don't demand respect in treating people with dignity because of the fact that they're a human and they're in that space and they have something important to say? So, and you know, I similar to you, I respect those who suggest that you absolutely should use these titles and they're important. and they signify power and all of the other things that they mean. I understand that. I get it. I acknowledge that that's exactly what they mean as well. But to your point, I think of those folks that don't have that power and don't have those titles. And I think to be able to command attention and respect because of who you are and what you have to say and what you contribute should be enough. So I just want to, you know, acknowledge that I love that perspective. I respect it. And I think it's kind of cool. So
thank you. I appreciate that affirmation.
Absolutely. So I want to follow this up a little bit because you've touched on this a few times. The intersectionality and complexity of having these often not multiple identities, but oftentimes multiple marginalized identities, right? So you gave us the example of, you know, people suggesting that you have to use your titles because that's the only way, or that's one way that you're going to get respect or get be able to garner more attention or power in particular situations. And that's has a lot to do with being a woman, right? I have heard, right. You know, even with white women, I've heard people say similar things. So trying to remove the race part of it.
Right.
But certainly there's a racialized piece of this as well, where people are suggesting you do that because being Black, you want to, you know, show that you belong in that space and that you have important things to say. So I think there's like this huge amount of pressure for folks who have multiple marginalized identities, being in, you know, being of immigrant descent, right? And sort of navigating that space too, being a mom, a parent, an administrator, like having all of these identities, a partner, a spouse, that you have to navigate. How do you do that? Like, you know, some people say when they go to work, they turn off being a parent. If they're a parent when they go to work, you know, I'm not mom anymore when I go to work. I'm associate dean or I'm professor. And then you have others who say they can't do that. They are absolutely all of those things at once. And because of that, you know, it takes a lot of energy and effort to manage those identities. So could you just share, you know, what does that mean to you? I know I've said a lot and it probably isn't very coherent, but what does
that
mean
to you? No, it really
was.
I mean, it's very thought-provoking what you're asking. And I don't know how much I've reflected on this idea of turning on and off various aspects of my identity. I know that whatever room I'm in, I bring the version of myself that most speaks to that room. And, you know, so if I'm in the mom space and I'm activating that, but, you know, a lot of parts of my personality are actually really integrated. So even as I sit here and I'm working, I know that I'm doing this for my children. I'm doing this for my mother, I'm doing this for students of color and students of all backgrounds who might be listening, you know, so I feel like I'm bringing my full self to the table most of the time. And the person who modeled that for me is actually Mari Castañeda, the dean of the Honors College, because when she speaks, she always integrates Spanish in there and she always brings her full identity to the table. The one place where I have faced a challenge, though, is when I think about where I came from, because I came from a very low income background, to a point where we had housing insecurity, food insecurity, lots of resource insecurities. And even when I came to college, this was the majority of my childhood that happened for. And when I went to college, I had to stay in a graduate dorm because it was year round and I didn't have a place to go during college breaks. And so that was one version of my life, right? And then here I am, a senior administrator with a PhD from an Ivy League institution. And, you know, I had success pretty early on in life. And I have a two-parent home. You know, I'm part of a couple that's raising two biracial children in a nice neighborhood in Amherst. And it's like, how do those two things, it's interesting to think about how my marginalized identities, but also my privileged identities, how do I reconcile that? You know, how do I bring that together? So that's more been the challenge for me, is sometimes just trying to get my head around where I came from and where I am now. And I know that a lot of students struggle with feeling like they come from one world, they're living in another world, but they don't belong to either world. And yeah. So that's something that I also am trying to negotiate.
Wow, that's a lot, right? And a lot of that resonates with me as well. And I think, you know, we have Anthony Jack, that's, you know, an assistant professor at Harvard who's coming to campus this Thursday to talk about this idea of the privileged poor.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah. And I think, you know, so much of what you're saying is in alignment with some of the things that he will be talking about. And I think speaking to this idea of understanding how students and faculty and staff even are having to navigate these worlds that don't necessarily align with each other is a lot. It's a lot for people to deal with. And it leads me right into my next question of self-care. Which I think is, you know, I feel like when I started my career, no one spoke about self-care. It was, work hard, push through. You'll be fine. Take your vacation time if you need it. If not, work through vacation. There've been many years that I haven't taken vacation time, right? I've taken time off and I've used it to write, to catch up on work. But I think the research is overwhelming in support of self-care and taking time off from the really busy and often hectic lives that we live. So what are some things that you do for self-care? How do you support yourself? How do you affirm yourself? Because, you know, certainly it's an important part of how we sustain the work that we're doing.
So I have very little ego. It's hard for me to think about myself and talk about myself sometimes. But when I think about myself as a vessel for the greater good, then I realize that's something that I want to invest in. That's something that I want to nourish. Like I am going to be at my best when I'm feeling my best and I can do my best work. And so there are a couple of ways that I take care of myself. First of all, I have a routine every morning. I work out. I get up at about 4 or 5 o'clock in the morning. I work out, I watch movies while I work out. And then after I work out, I listen to really loud, empowering music that I'm singing along to, you know, just to kind of get my head in a certain space.
Yeah.
And I still put my makeup on every day and I think of it, you know, I'm not in a war, but I do think of it as sort of like warrior paint, just putting on my face for the day. And then I work 10 to 12 hours a day on most days. And I find that if I start to feel a little tired and run down, if I just step away and either take a walk for 10 minutes or even just kind of walk away from my computer and close my eyes for like 5 minutes, like I actually get replenished. I feel a lot of rejuvenation just from taking those small breaks. And then the final thing that I'll say is that I have found profound support within the UMass community. I have so many resources for replenishment and affirmation within the UMass community. And that includes UNEF and the circle that we're a part of. But there are lots of other circles that I'm a part of that I can turn to, and lots of particular individuals that I can turn to for anything that I need. So I feel very fortunate. It's one of the benefits I've always cheered on about UMass. It's large enough that you can find your people, and I have lots of people here.
Yeah, I love that. And 4 or 5 a.m., that's early.
I have to beat my kids. My kids get up at 6. And I need to feel like I can be slow and take my time and, you know, like I'm not going to end up needing to rush. So I just need to ease into my day. But my kids wake up at 6, so I have to beat them to it. I have to get up and get my workout in before they wake up.
No, I get that. I don't have kids, but there was a point where I would work out every day at 5 a.m. And just to have the quiet time of not having to think about emails because no one's up emailing you and is quiet outside. And I also would watch Netflix mostly. And it would be, I got on this really long binge of watching Black Mirror. And it's, you know, it's, for me, it was a little bit of self-care as well. It was one I needed to work out because I was just getting really out of shape and felt bad about it. But also it was self-care. It was having time to myself. So thank you for sharing that, because I think, at least for me personally, I love to hear about people's routines. I feel like I can pull a little something from everyone's routine that might resonate with me and will add something to my life. So thank you. So thank you so much for being with us here today, Anne-Marie. It's been an absolute pleasure to talk with you. I think you've shared so much wisdom that, you know, certainly will help support students think about their identities and their sense of belonging here at UMass and beyond, but also faculty and staff and others in our community. And I just think your story is amazing. There's so many aspects of it and pivots that you've taken. So to hear you talk through that with us is enlightening. So thank you for your time. It's been an absolute pleasure.
Thank you. Same here, Nat. Thank you for inviting me. This was a wonderful conversation.
Absolutely. So again, I just want to say thank you to Dr. Anne-Marie Russell, Associate Dean, for joining our pod today. And to our listeners, thank you for listening to our podcast. We look forward to bringing you more stories and interviews throughout the semester. Tune in next week for our final interview in this series on women and gender diversity at UMass. We will have the Dean of the College of Humanities and Fine Arts, Dr. Barbara Krofheimer, is joining us on the show. Until next time, continue to tune in to the DARIA podcast.